Shri Metram Arbhaktivar Yavayom Graminam Prati Upasto Dormada Prokto Nitir Guda Uchayate. The city called Gramaka, which is approached through the lower gate of Asuri, the genital, is meant for sex, which is very pleasing to common men who are simply fools and rascals. The faculty of procreation is called Durmada, and the rectum is called Nirti. Srila Prabhupada's purport. When the world becomes degraded, civilization becomes demoniac. And for the common man, the rectum and the genital are taken very seriously as the centers of all activity. Even in such a sacred place as Vrindavana, India, unintelligent men pass off this rectal and genital business as spiritual activity. Such people are called sahajya. According to their philosophy, through sexual indulgence, one can elevate oneself to the spiritual platform. From these verses of Srimad Bhagavatam, however, we understand that the desires for sexual satisfaction are meant for the arvak, the lowest among men. To rectify these rascals and fools is very difficult. After all, the sex desires of the common man are condemned in these verses. The word durmada means wrongly directed, and nirti means sinful activity. Although this clearly indicates that sex indulgence is abominable and misdirected, even from the ordinary point of view, the sahajas nonetheless pass themselves off as devotees, conducting spiritual activities. For this reason, Vrindavana is no longer visited by intelligent men. Sometimes we are often asked why we have made our center in Vrindavana. From the external point of view, it can be concluded that Vrindavana has become degenerate due to these sahajya activities. And yet, from the spiritual point of view, Vrindavana is the only place where all these sinful persons can be rectified by means of taking birth in the forms of dogs, hogs, and monkeys. By living in Vrindavana as a dog, hog, or monkey, the living entity can be elevated to the spiritual platform in the next life. That's a good explanation. That's why you see so many dogs, hogs, and monkeys in Vrindavan. We have to treat them as fallen souls, formerly great yogis, perhaps. This is, of course, speaking about sexual matters is one of the most difficult parts of Krishna consciousness to understand, to speak about. Because we can see around us, wherever we look, that the entire world is based on sex life. Srila Prabhupada has pointed that out infinite amount of times, and it's so visible and so easy to see. And especially he's talking about this modern age, how the entire world is revolving around the sexual principle, the attraction between male and female, how all activities are simply based on this attraction, this desire. This is a form of material nature's bondage. It is her most strictest bondage. By sex life, we become bound up with material nature stronger than by any other type of desire. When I'm sitting up in my room, quite often I look out and watch the pigeons living in the roofs around me. And after some time, I began to see very clearly how this is so in the pigeon life, that everything is based upon the sex urge. The male pigeon, I mean, all of these pigeons look alike to me, but perhaps maybe they look better to each other. Some pigeon looks better to another pigeon than another pigeon, but they all seem to look alike to me. Anyway, one pigeon will select a mate. He will fight off all of the other quarters, other pigeons, male pigeons, who are after this particular mate. And then they have some sex life, and then he has to start working to find a nest, and she has to work to build this nest. And then they have to protect against the crows. The crows are always coming to invade the nest and steal the eggs. So their life is, and then the children are born, they have to feed them. So they have to go for food twice as much, three times as much to feed these babies. So on and on this life goes. And then as soon as the children are raised and gone out, again they start. Just see how intricately knotted up we are in this material world. It's no different with the human species. Because my eye travels then down the building and I watch the people below in their courtyards. How they come out and they do the laundry and they bring the children out from the house who are playing around, and the man goes off to work and the woman works all day scrubbing the clothes and preparing the meals, and the man comes home in the evening exhausted and he's gives all his money to the wife who goes shopping, and the children are growing and growing and requiring more and more material things to support them. So this is going on in the human life below as well. Because once you have sex, then you have wife, you have to have work, you have to have a home, you have to have some land, you have some children, and this begets friends. This begets societies of friends. You begin to join clubs and become associated with all types of different people. It requires money. It requires a country. It requires politics. My God, it's totally in total entanglement from one sense, one physical urge. For just 15 minutes of your life, you lose everything. And you become completely attached that I am this body, completely convinced I am this body, that everything is relates to I, me, or mine. This is the mindset of someone in the material world. When in fact, if you examine it, sex is merely, Prabhupada used to describe it, it's just an itching of the skin. The skin itches. It's a tingling of the skin, and the skin itches. So simply ignoring this itch is very difficult, very difficult. You've ever had an itch in your skin, a mosquito bite or something? To stop itching it is almost impossible. You think, well, if I just go like that once, it's gone. But then it just seems to keep coming back and coming back, this itching of the skin. And Srila Prabhupada often told me that no one is free from this itching. No one is free. Men, women, even in old age, one is not free from this itching. It travels with us in this form of life, in this body. One time I remember walking into Srila Prabhupada's room early in the morning, and he was sitting behind his desk, and in front of him he had a brochure, a pamphlet. I believe it was from the Cayman Islands or Bermuda or some exotic island in the Caribbean. It was an advertising brochure. And on the front of the brochure was a yacht with this beautiful woman in a bikini lounging back on the front of the yacht with her legs spread. And Prabhupada looked up at me and he looked back down at this thing and he said, "You see, even as an old man, one is attracted to the vagina. This never goes away, this urging." But sex itself is not contrary to religious principles, to Dharma. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says in the seventh chapter, 11th verse, that I am the sex life, not outside Vedic principles. And in the 10th canto, in the 28th verse, He says, of all the causes of procreation, I am Kandarpa, the sex desire for producing Krishna-conscious children. So sex is there, even in the spiritual world. So if the whole world is trapped in this cycle, this material sex desire cycle, how do I get out of this cycle? Well, first we have to understand and agree that this is a hellish condition. This is the first step, to understand that this is a hellish, irrevocable situation. And I want to get out. I need to get out. I want to get out. This desire must be there first. Just like sometimes you look around and you see the ants. I see these in my room also. I'm studying lots of wildlife in my room. The ants are going back and forth all day after some small particle of sugar. And if you stop and think, what is this ant aware of? This ant is not aware or has no cognizance that I am standing there, that this huge being is standing beside him, that he has no idea of what I am or anything about me, so much bigger than that ant, millions of times bigger than that ant. So this is our position in the material world. We are just like these ants, and we have no idea that this huge world exists outside of our ant life. Or someone who can see only in black and white. Supposing you could only see everything around you in black and white, no color. How could you imagine what is color? You couldn't imagine what is color. What is red, what is green, what is blue, what is yellow. You couldn't imagine this if all you had the ability to see was black and white. So we find ourselves in these types of positions in the material world. We only can see black and white. We can't even imagine what it's like outside of our black and white perspective or outside of our ant-like dimension, how big things can really be. So this information about the world, bigger world, it only can come by approaching a spiritual, bona fide spiritual master. Somehow or other, by the grace of our spiritual master, we encounter him and he informs us of this world outside, so much bigger than we are. And if we're serious, we can actually achieve a state of self-restraint, which is called the dhira stage or the sober stage, when material sex life no longer affects us. In this stage, we see all living entities on the same platform, men, women, children, old people, all living entities. We see them all on the same platform. That way, there's no desire for sex, because we see them all as Krishna's creations, equally. And the spiritual master will teach us that this shell I'm living in, my spirit, me, my soul, lives inside this shell, but this shell is only made of skin. It's made of a material substance we call skin. In fact, I read somewhere the other day that if you equate the size of a molecule in our skin to, the size of a cricket ball, say this big, that the distance to the next molecule in our skin would be about from here to the sun, equivalently. So actually we are made mostly of air. We are mostly space. We don't even really exist except through material eyes. We see each other. This is not a very dense substance. It seems dense to us. It's only relative. So we have this skin disease called sex life, sex urge. It's like a skin disease, a disease of the shell. And the spiritual master teaches us that I am not this skin. And he teaches us to tolerate this skin, this itching sensation. Make the use of a bad bargain, Prabhupada always used to say. It's a bad bargain, but we can't get rid of it. We have to make the best use of it. So he says, well, for most of us, this is true. If you must have sex, then you have children. You have children. But only if you're prepared to make them immortal. Only if you're prepared to raise a child to become immortal. That this is his last body, his or her last little body in this chain of bodies. Only under those conditions is one allowed to have sex life. But most of all, the spiritual master, I think, shows us that there's a world of pleasure, a world of color, much, much higher than our little ant's view, our materialist's view. That this world of pleasure is so vast and so rich and so deep, it makes the momentary pleasure of sex life disgustingly small. Only when we become aware and that of that period of that pleasure that's possible for us can sex life be eliminated, sexual desire be eliminated. All energy is borrowed by us from the Lord's reservoir. The Lord is the reservoir of all energy, and we borrow some little bit. So the actions resulting from this expenditures of the Lord's energy, they have to be given back to the Lord in loving devotional service. This is our process. And this way, the sex attraction becomes replaced by a much higher attraction. Sex life is suicide for the one who wants to improve his or her existence. It's just like suicide. It's like knowing something and then knowingly not doing that. It's just like cutting your own throat, putting a gun to your head. I will have sex life. It's just like committing suicide. Because purification, in order to achieve this state or experience this state of higher pleasure, one has to purify oneself. One has to be qualified to enjoy in the higher transcendental realms of pleasure. And the only process for achieving this purification is getting free gradually of sex desire. A brahmachari life means that he's simply interested in the spiritual master's guidance and follows these principles under his direction. Just like Prabhupada, I'll go back to some more personal examples. When Srila Prabhupada first came into our lives back in the early, mid-60s in San Francisco, this was a period of almost unleashed, unlimited sensual pleasure. During the rise of the hippie culture, there was a motto that was on everyone's lips. Just do your thing. Whatever makes you feel good, do it. So pleasure was taken to its maximum extreme, especially amongst the young people. Drugs of every variety and description were used widely by everyone to try to feel good. Whatever makes you feel good. New drugs would come. Oh, let's try that. Oh, that makes me feel so good. Alcohol. Oh, I feel great. This was going on at a huge level. Sex. Women, it was called the age of free love, you might have read in the books. All girls were available, all men were available for sex. It was an experimental period where you could practically ask any girl walking down the street, you want to have some sex? Oh, sure, let's go. It was one of those very rare and unusual periods when there were no social or no societal restraints on young people's energy. This is an amazing period of time. So here comes Prabhupada. He walks into the middle of this And he says, during this most degraded period of history, he says, all right, stop your sex life now. You give up your drugs. Stop eating meat. And no more gambling or risking anything. Can you imagine how he could do this? Well, he did it only, there was only one way he could do it. He had to promise us there was something higher. He said that Krishna is the reservoir of all pleasure. And if you give up these things, you can taste that pleasure. He said, when you take some drug or have some sex, isn't there a period of depression and coming down from that high period? Well, yes. But once you get Krishna, fixed up in Krishna consciousness, there's no coming down. And this attracted us, this idea. Everyone who indulges to the extreme that we indulge began to feel a little bit sick of it anyway. We could tell that this wasn't, no matter how we expended our bodies on these material pleasures, we were not getting actual satisfaction. There was something missing. And here comes Prabhupada, and he says, if you can experience the spiritual divine pleasure which never ends, and in fact always increases, it gets better and better. There's no limit. No limit means it only can get better and better and better and better. Well, we like this idea. We could tell he was always happy. He was always in jolly mood. And some of his devotees, older devotees, who had been around a little few months longer than we had, we could see, well, they're very happy, and they're not having sex and taking drugs. Maybe there's something to this. So we began publicizing, putting out these leaflets on the street to the other hippies that said things like, stay high forever. Come and see Srila Prabhupada speak. And Prabhupada used to tell us that our bodies are like temples. And if we want the spiritual life, we have to treat the body as if it is a temple. It's our vehicle for attaining spiritual bliss. So we have to take care of this body and use it properly. And he weaned us very gradually into this idea. It wasn't that he said, stop this, stop this, stop this, and didn't replace it with anything. First he started us chanting. And he said, you just see, it's easy, try it. Chant Hare Krishna and see. And as we began chanting, we began to feel something happening. There's a physical result to chanting that you all know. You begin to feel good. And the more you chant, the better you feel. Well, we thought, well, then there must be something to this. And then when he spoke, and he spoke every night in those days, and every morning also, it got to be so we would rush to the temple to hear Srila Prabhupada speak. We didn't want to miss one lecture that he gave, one session with Srila Prabhupada, because just being around him began to be the most pleasurable experiences in our young lives. Just to see him, just to watch his face and listen to the words come out of his beautiful mouth. He had the most expressive, beautiful, big mouth. And the expressions in his eyes as he would speak, obviously a foremost authority. And he was promising us a way out of all this problematical sex-oriented life that we were suffering under. And some of us, he could see that we were too attached to sex life. So he said, well, you get married then. No problem. Just get married. So I was one of those. He got me married. He got several of my godbrothers married. So that was, now I had wife. Now I had to get a job. Now I had to work to support. And practically the sex life that I anticipated went away anyway, because I had to work so hard to support this wife. But she became my spiritual companion. She forced me when I was weak to go to the temple and forced me to become more Krishna conscious. By her presence I began to feel more inclined to listen to what Prabhupada said and practice what he said. So this is the ideal situation for marriage, that the man and the wife push each other in moments of weakness. They push each other toward Krishna. It's a very nice arrangement for the weak of flesh, like myself and perhaps many others. But more than just getting us married, I mean, there were many unmarried boys in the group as well. He engaged us. He engaged us full time in spreading Krishna consciousness. You sometimes often ask me and are wondering how Krishna consciousness spread so fast in the early days, how it went out and went all over the world so fast. Well, one answer is it's almost, you can say, it was sublimated sex desire. Prabhupada took all of those energies associated with sex desire and made us work to spread Krishna consciousness. He employed us. He engaged us in spreading Krishna consciousness. By using our energy that way, we were always too exhausted to think about sex life. Remember, in these times, we had no parental guidance. Our social system had broken down completely. The communications between children and parents was no longer there. There was a big generational gap. We had nothing to do with our parents' generation. We wanted to forge a new world. So we didn't have the constraints of society or tradition. No social guides, like perhaps many of you have inherited from your Indian culture, from your Vedic culture. So it made it all the more difficult. We only could find one guide, and that was Srila Prabhupada. We had no other way of guiding ourselves. We became completely dependent upon Prabhupada's guidance. But the taste was in the proof of the pudding was in the tasting. As we began to spread Krishna consciousness and chant Hare Krishna more and more, we began to feel pleasure, pleasant. We began to feel physically pleasant, relieved of anxieties. That's one of the most painful things in life, are the anxieties of daily struggle, the stress and the fear that go along with material activities. When you don't have those, if you're only working for Krishna, spread Krishna consciousness, you don't have any fear. Krishna makes you fearless. He says, if you just go out and preach my name, nothing will happen to you. So we tested this, and it worked. He said, if you spread Krishna consciousness, you won't have anxieties, because Krishna accepts all the results, good or bad. He loves only the service. So we began to feel this. It was like the bonds breaking on our lives. We were being freed up by this Krishna consciousness. Then gradually Prabhupada introduced some of the other rules and regulations, but by then we were almost following them anyway. He had us engaged. The first job that I had in Krishna consciousness, before Prabhupada even came to San Francisco, I wanted to help Mukunda find a space for a temple. So I remember that, walking all over the place, talking with real estate agents, meeting with influential hippies in the neighborhood, and trying to get us a central location that might be emptied. And so little by little, I began replacing my old activities with Krishna conscious activities. And then raising money. We never had any money, so it was a constant search for money to push on Krishna's work, get to society, establish the second branch of Krishna consciousness in the world. Then there was, before Prabhupada came, we thought to have some very big event to attract him to come and attract all the hippies to come and meet Srila Prabhupada. So that was the idea for this mantra rock dance. In those days, the whole center of the hippie community revolved around these weekend dances in these ballrooms where several thousand people would come and smoke pot and take LSD and listen to the musicians and dance in the dark with strobe lights and other mystical effects. So getting this organized and putting this together was no small job. So this way we became completely immersed in working for Krishna. Prabhupada kind of trapped us in a way. He said this little thing first, and then once you get started, then a little bit more, and then a little bit more, and then pretty soon it's full time. And one of the easiest parts of this transition, the search for the higher pleasure, is in because of the society of your fellow god brothers and sisters. In a society of devotees, it makes it much, much, much easier. If you are alone trying to conquer the sexual urge alone, it's almost impossible. But in the society of devotees around you, god brothers and sisters, this becomes much, much, much easier. And it was for us in those days also. I remember you were talking a couple of months ago about strength through unity. Well, this is one of the most visible effects of that principle, that by shoring up with our god brothers, I mean, how can I think about going out and having sex with somebody if my god brothers expect me to be at class this morning and chanting my rounds? It's just not possible. But if they are not there to pull me around like this, then I may wander off. So this is one of the benefits of a Krishna conscious society. My wife in those days, she wanted to have a child. She had the motherly instinct. So we had one child, Saraswati. And this was the first child born in Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada took very special love of this child. He named her over the telephone. He was in Montreal. I called him up and said, "Srila Prabhupada, we have the baby. It is born. It is a girl." And immediately he said, "Oh, then she will be named Saraswati." And when we brought Saraswati to see Srila Prabhupada for the first time in Montreal, he just picked her up and held her, this laughing and smiling all over. And he was so proud to be the spiritual father of this child. So she was an example of how you do the sexual urge is controlled. This was the only child we had. After that, life became too busy to think about growing more family. In those days, we didn't have the facilities, perhaps, that they have now for householder life, or there were no householders in the society with children except us. We were the only ones. Now they have farms and so many other ways that householders can join together and work in Krishna consciousness, that's very nice. But, you know, in so many logical ways Prabhupada would explain about sex life also. He would say that, okay, not having sex is an austerity, is a sacrifice. But so is saving, for example, saving money for a car or saving money for a new sari. You go through some sacrifice to save that money. You abjure the spending of that money in order to have this new thing that you're going to buy with it. So there's no difference. But in this sense, you abstain from sex in order to get the highest pleasure, which is Krishna's love. I remember all those years that I wrote Srila Prabhupada's letters, that I typed Srila Prabhupada's letters. I think that probably the most common question he got, the very most common question he got from his devotees was about these sexual matters. About, should I get married? I'm not able to control my urges, blah, blah, blah. And Prabhupada would always answer. He would always answer and give them some advice. He would say things like, if you're feeling this urge, you just go sit in the temple in front of the deities and start chanting. Just by gazing upon, I could see what he means by that, because just by gazing upon the deities and the beauty of Radha and Krishna on the altar and chanting around, chanting Hare Krishna, this sexual urge will go away. It's replaced by this higher taste. I want that. I don't want this. I want that. Or plunge yourself into Krishna consciousness activity. If you feel there's, I mean, sex desire is the product of an idle hands and an idle mind, let's face it. If you have time to think about sex desire and fantasy about sex, then you're not busy enough. Plunge yourself into some Krishna consciousness activity. There are so many. There are more than can ever be done by unlimited amounts of devotees. And once it's going, once you have this, the ball of momentum is rolling, this quelling of the sex urge, once that's going for you, don't lose it. It's very important not to lose it. Of course, we may fall down. That's always possible. But it's important to try very hard not to lose that. That is the energy that you have developed and that you are the master of. So just stop any other urges and master that energy. Become stronger in that energy. We are always able to go out using Krishna's energy to spread Krishna consciousness to all of these millions of unfortunates that we see around us in every street, in every house, who have never been exposed to Krishna. So they are trapped in material existence. The devotees should feel compassion for these people. Nothing but great, great compassion for these people. He should feel great pity that these people are living a life bound up by sex desire and by material, and therefore by material entanglements. And he should feel obligated to help these people. It's your responsibility now. You have this knowledge. They don't. If you don't give it to them, no one else will. And if you don't give it to them, then you are to blame. It's a very important position to have this knowledge and be a devotee of Krishna. It doesn't mean that I sit and enjoy Krishna's energy. It means that I go out and spread Krishna consciousness and allow other people also to join in this energy. Then my energy, my pleasure increases by doing this. You watch. The more people you turn on to Krishna consciousness, the happier you get. My pleasure is going to diminish by going out into the hot streets and preaching Krishna consciousness. No, it gets better and better and increases more and more. Srila Prabhupada, who preached and spread Krishna consciousness to millions, he was the happiest of all. His pleasure, just to see him relishing the pleasure of Krishna's energy, is, you never saw such a thing. You didn't think it's possible that someone could enjoy life that much. We have examples on the videos and in the cinemas and in the newspapers of people enjoying life. And we think sometimes, oh, they can enjoy material life and I cannot. Or they can enjoy a higher type of material life than I can because they have money, because they have good looks. That's simply not the case. The devotee enjoys far more than the richest movie star on this planet. He enjoys Krishna's proximity. He enjoys Krishna's love. He shares something with the divine that it's inexplicably better. It's the world of color, of technicolor. While these people are still living in the world of black and white. He walks with the giants, and they're still thinking that the ant's life is all there is. Does anyone have any questions about any of these topics? Yes. Not that I'm very qualified to answer them, but try.
Thank you very much for nice class. Proji, in the episode of Pubja, in the Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada writes that when Pubja invited Krishna, and she was very lusty for Krishna, she wanted to have kind of sexual relation with Krishna. But Krishna refused and he accepted other service like getting smeared by Chandan and such thing. And he kept his feet on her chest and he relieved her from lust. So in that episode, Prabhupada writes, in spiritual relationships, like Madhurya Ras, there may be embracing and kissing, but there is no sex life as we know here. So, sometimes, like you spoke, that there is sex life in spiritual world also. So it's little confusing. So how two things?
Well, I'm not very qualified to speak on that higher level of spiritual sex life. Prabhupada says in one of his purports that before one approaches the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, that one should first look at the feet of Krishna without any that one should first look at the feet of Krishna in a very pure manner. I'm still at the stage of trying to look at Krishna's feet and remain pure. I can't even look up his body and think about these higher sexual pursuits in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam or even in Krishna book. These things are all described by Srila Prabhupada much better than me. I'm not that familiar with them. I remember one story that Srila Prabhupada was very fond of in that respect. That you probably all know the story, that there was some king very much attracted to a very beautiful lady, and she refused his advances many times, and finally he was very insistent. So she said, "All right, if you come back in 1 month and you still love me, are attracted by me, then you can have me." So the king went away, and she began to purge herself and vomit, and all of the vomit and bile from her body she placed in a bucket. She would eat things that made her sick, and she vomited up all of this pus and bile and bad things, excrement in her body. So at the end of 1 month, she was very wrinkled and gaunt and very ugly. And the king came to her, she showed him the bucket, and she says, "This is my beauty. Now do you still want me?" So the devotee sees that everyone, the bodies around him, they have a past, they have a future, they have a history. A devotee doesn't see a person just at that moment. He sees the person's past and the future and knows that they come from nothing and will go to nothing, that they are just a bag of bones surrounded by skin. He doesn't see a sexual urge. As far as what Krishna does in that respect, I'm really not qualified to speak about that. I don't know. Perhaps someday, if I get above the ankles and the toes, I can tell you more. Anyone else? Yes. The microphone? Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
A child, if he doesn't become Krishna conscious, that is the mistake of the parents. Suppose the parents doesn't train the child properly. So he may be devotee or he may be outside person, outside karnis even then. If they don't train the child properly, and the child life gets spoiled, that mistake is not the child, but the parents. So, in this case, how the karma acts upon the child, is it child's mistake is also there in the previous life, or how to understand that?
Yes, the child, the product of a non-Krishna conscious household. Is that what you're saying? If a non-Krishna conscious family has a child, and that child is also non-Krishna conscious, is that the fault of the child? Yeah.
Krishna conscious. And that means, even if, suppose the devotee is there, and he could not train the child properly, and he has not become proper Krishna conscious, then also, like, if you take the karmi side also, and this side also, means, in both cases, the child has got spoiled. So, that is whose mistake, like, that is parents' mistake, but the child is victim for that. So, if he becomes elder, and he repents himself that something has, if I have come across a good training, then I would have become a good person. So, in that case, means, what is the mistake of the child?
Well, if a Krishna conscious devotee has children and they do not train them in Krishna consciousness, they are more at fault or more guilty of anarthas than the non-devotee. In other words, if I have the knowledge that I'm supposed to train this child in Krishna consciousness and I fail, then I have to take the karmic consequences for that. In a much bigger way than a materialist would, who has no exposure to Krishna consciousness. If I fail in my obligation to raise this child in Krishna consciousness, then I'm very much to blame. Although sometimes, no matter what I do, the child will go away. But I have to do my best to train the child in Krishna consciousness. There may be some circumstance where the child is taken away by some other circumstance and falls down in Krishna consciousness. Then I'm not to blame. But I must do my best to bring that child up in Krishna consciousness. And as Prabhupada used to say, make that child immortal, that he doesn't have to come back again into this material life. But sometimes circumstances are beyond my control. If the child goes away to school or something and meets some bad people and they take him away, what can I do? No, I try my best.
You're telling about a sincere person who is trying. A person who has not tried, like who has spoiled the child. So he will take the reaction, he will take the suffering. But what about the child, like... The child is victim. So,
if the child does not know about Krishna, or if the child knows about Krishna consciousness and knowingly goes away, despite the parents telling the child about Krishna, then the child has to take that responsibility. It's a difficult question in the sense that there each circumstance is different completely. But I would say that it's the parents' obligation to try to guide the child in Krishna consciousness as much as possible, right up until old age. But there is a chance the child will fall. It's not always 100%. So however much karmic blame is there, it will vary from situation to situation. But there is a chance that it could all be the child's karma. It could be all the parents' karma. But probably some sort of mix of both. That answer? Okay. Anyone else?
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Thanks for your wonderful enlightenment. But we would like to know more about your relation with Prabhupada, because we want to take opportunity on Dvadasi Day. Some more Prabhupada Katha, if possible.
Give me some topic.
Your early days in England.
England.
George Harrison, how early. He came across, there is a...
When Prabhupada came to England, first time.
England, how you endeavor, your struggle.
Yes, by the time that Srila Prabhupada came to England, things had changed much in the Krishna conscious movement. Prabhupada was no longer an unheard of master. You know, by then he had already developed Krishna consciousness movement in a very large way in America. He was starting to become well known. Devotees were appearing in all of the streets of America. There were many newspaper article publicities talking about this Hare Krishna movement. It became well known. So by the time he came to England, Prabhupada was already a celebrity of sorts. But we tried to prepare his arrival in England so that he could appear like a king. He wanted to come to England so badly because his spiritual master had wanted him to speak in England. The English people had been very much a part of his upbringing in Calcutta. They were the British Raj was here in India. Everything was British. English language was spoken widely. So Srila Prabhupada wanted to come to England as like another type of king, the king of India, for a change. So we kept holding off his arrival in London until things were prepared in the way that he could be like a king when he came. So in fact, he was very regal in England. England was Prabhupada at his most regal, at his most majestic. He would sit just like the king of the world when he came to England. First thing, he gets picked up at the airport in a Rolls Royce limousine. Taken to one of the largest manor houses in England, this estate of John Lennon's, just very near Windsor Castle, which is where the Queen lived. In fact, to drive to John Lennon's, you had to pass Windsor Castle. And we told Prabhupada, this is where the Queen lived, and this is her castle. And he was very impressed. He liked it. Oh, it's very beautiful. And I said, and you live just behind it over here. And, oh, he liked that idea. So here he had this huge palace to live in with 80 acres of gardens, beautiful English gardens to walk in the morning. So right away he felt like a king. If you see the photographs from that period, those are the ones of Prabhupada with this majestic look on his face. And we tried to keep him in that style in England. That was the reason we held off getting any nice houses until they were the best, like Bhaktivedanta Manor. There also he acted like a king, lived like a king. It was his favorite place. Los Angeles and London, those were his two favorite places. And Bombay, I would say, in India. He would stay in those places. If you look at the chronology of all the places he went around the world so many times, he stayed the most time in Los Angeles, London, and Bombay, those three cities. Yes, that's in London picture.
Hare Krishna. Looks very majestic.
Yes, sitting on the lawns. I believe it was at John Lennon's place. Or in some park, maybe Regent's Park.
It is worldwide used mostly in temples.
Pardon?
It is worldwide used in all the temples in the altars. Maybe it is used much more than any other photo in the altars.
Yes.
Prabhupada compares how Motilal Nehru, when he sent his son Jawaharlal Nehru for education, there he had servants, English men as his servants at the different entries of the university. You remember that pastime?
He sent his son?
Motilal Nehru has sent his son Jawaharlal Nehru to England to educate in bar. I mean, lawyer.
Jawaharlal Nehru.
Yeah. Prabhupada said that he has to pay so much money to engage them as his servants. But Prabhupada said, I have so many servants in England who I will not pay anything for them. He was so happy with them.
Prabhupada had hundreds of American and English servants. He doesn't have to pay anything for them.
Whom he likes, American servants or English servants more? Looks like he's
he more liked American servants. Because when Prabhupada came to the West, he didn't know anything about our ways of life over there. He had didn't only maybe what he read in some newspapers or something, but he had, didn't have any clear idea how we worked and how we learned. And at that time, America was the superpower of the world, and the boys and girls that came to him first were members of the American society. So he took our, he wanted to understand our way of doing things because he saw that we like to do things in a big way. We like to spread things very quickly around the world. We were the masters of propaganda and advertising. So he wanted to catch the flavor that the young people of America had, the energy, the type of way we saw things. You know, we saw things in a very big way. We wanted to go things, do things fast. So he liked having American boys and girls around him to advising how to do these things. English people he thought as being in the past, that their empire has crumbled, that they simply sit around and talk. They don't act. Although he respected very much English intelligence, the intelligent people, scientists and so on of England, and very much he respected their culture. He said that there's only two places that a gentleman can live. He said, India and England. He liked the genteel way of life that the English people had. But as far as spreading Krishna consciousness, he thought that their race was, their days were over for that. That now the American way was what he was attracted to.
The Radha Krishna album, which you have made with the support of George Harrison, actually it is completely different from the pop music of the time, either the tunes or the... Yesterday, somehow I was hearing that cassette. I have that. It is nothing, you know, something mystical behind it. It looks like any other normal... But how it...
Well, if you listen, did you hear? Listen to Hare Krishna Mantra?
Yeah.
It sounds like a pop song. It has all the things. It has guitar music. It has rhythm. It has a beginning and an end. It goes very fast toward the end, and then bong, has a surprise ending. So it fit very much with the rock and roll format of the times.
Still mystical.
It's very mystical. That's all very mystical. And the fact that George Harrison produced it was a big factor in making it very big. Automatically through Apple Records, which was George's, the Beatles' recording company, they had a distribution, a very wide distribution of musical records. So all we had to do is plug Hare Krishna Mantra into their distribution system, and it went out widely, along with lots of propaganda, buy this record, because George likes it. So everyone bought the record. But it is very mystic how all that happened. Unfortunately, it wasn't released in the USA, that record. Otherwise, it would have been a big hit also in USA. But there was some politics involved. The distributor for Apple Records in USI is a company called Capitol Records at that time, Capitol Records. And Capitol Records was controlled and owned largely by Catholics, Christians. And they didn't want to have a record popular about some other religion. This we found out later, why they didn't release it. Everyone was surprised why they didn't release in USA. It was for that reason. Nowadays, probably they would release it, but in those days, things were different. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.